Hello.
Hello.
My name is Darsha Narvaez. I'm a faculty member in the Department of Psychology at the University of Notre Dame. And I study moral development, moral character, education, and ethics in psychological terms, mostly. I've had different careers, being a musician and a teacher and other things, but I'm a psychologist now.
Okay, and I'm Dan Sperber, and I'm a French cognitive and social scientist, and I have a research position at the Institut Nico in Paris, and I also teach at the Central European University in Budapest, both in the cognitive science department and in the philosophy department.
All right, well, I will lead the discussion here. I have several questions about the argumentative theory that you and Mercier have published about.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the first place to start is with argumentative theory, if you can say a little bit about it.
Yeah, sure. So it's a work that Hugo Mercier and I have been doing for a while. Hugo has done his PhD with me. Now he's at the University of Pennsylvania, and he did it on an idea which I just outlined and which has contributed to developing much more radically, which regards reasoning, and which is a way to, well, let me just state the basic idea. The basic idea is that reasoning, human reasoning, is not so much a tool for individual thinking, you know, for our thinking on our own in order to arrive at better judgment and better decisions. Its main function is basically to argue with others and to examine the arguments that others present us in order to convince us. So it's both to convince others and not to be convinced without some good reasons. So it's a much more social type of activity. So that's the basic idea of argumentative theory, and I'm sure we'll see more details as our conversation proceeds.
Okay. So in my view, reasoning and rationality in human beings is for many things,
mm-hmm.
and develops from has parallels in animals, because I see the animals in our yard problem solving continuously when I put barriers up.
Sure.
For trying to keep the squirrels away from
mm-hmm.
the seeds, and
yeah.
they sit there and they think about how to meet the new challenge.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you can tell us what your definition then is of reasoning, because I think it's quite a bit narrower than how I would view it.
Well, historically, you know, reasoning has been used for a kind of fairly reflective kind of mental activity where you ponder reasons in order to arrive at a decision or at a belief or at a judgment. But of course, there's a wider sense, which indeed has become fairly common, both in the study of animal cognition, in the study of infant cognition, where reasoning is synonymous with what I would prefer to call inference. So indeed, both your squirrels and babies and all of us draw intuitive inference all the time. That is, we make split-second decisions, we come to form beliefs which go well beyond what we perceive, we form preferences and so on, expectations, and we do that not reflectively, but very spontaneously, very intuitively, almost instinctively. And the difference between that inference in the wide sense and reasoning in the narrow sense in which I use the term is that in intuitive inference, we don't pay attention to the reasons. It's not that we don't have reasons, it's not that we couldn't pay attention to reasons, we don't. It's much faster, we go at it kind of automatically. In reasoning proper, as we use the term, we pay attention to reasons. And the basic idea here of argumentative theory, we don't pay so much attention to reason for ourselves in our own thinking, we pay attention to reasons that others give us, or that we may give others. So it's, again, much more to do with argumentation, with convincing others, and being convinced or not convinced oneself.
Okay, so really the reasoning that you're focused on is social reasoning. It's not the reasoning we do when we're problem solving.
Well, that's the question. I mean, it's the reasoning that, you know, that we also do quite often on our own. And, you know, think of Descartes trying to rethink everything, you know, to base his knowledge of everything, of the world, of himself and so on solid principle by reasoning, by you know, taking the only thing he was sure of, namely that since he was thinking, he existed, and trying to build on that. So that's not a social activity, he's doing it on his own. Of course, he's thinking of a book he will write later, or arguments he will share with others. So I'm thinking of reasoning in the sense in which it's been discussed in the philosophy of reasoning, in the psychology of reasoning, and the idea that there's much more problem solving, as you put it, or and even, you know, more generally intuitive inference, all going on all the time, and not just in grown-up humans, but in everybody and in all kinds of animals. That's a fairly novel idea. So in the history of philosophy, you know, from Aristotle to Descartes and Kant and so on, when they talk about reasoning, they talk it. I'm using it in the sense in which they were using it, it seems to me.
Except you do have a definition. You say it's a special form of inference. I'm reading from the paper. At the conceptual level, where not only is a new mental representation or conclusion consciously produced, but the previously held representations or premises that warrant it are also consciously entertained.
Yes,
you depend on consciousness here.
Yes, it depends. Yes, there's an awareness of reasons. I mean, again, when you think of all the choice you make, the decision made, the expectation you have, some you arrive at pondering the reasons. Others will just come to mind directly. Here we are particularly interested in those form of inference where we are aware of the reason, we ponder the reason. And why is it a special problem? Because there's a mystery, there's an enigma, if you want, regarding reasoning in that sense. In the wider sense where squirrels and babies and everybody else does it all the time, it's not a big mystery. I mean, animals move around in the world and they have to guide their movements on the basis of information about the world, not just information they perceive, but also information they can infer about what's going to happen next, what's behind the bush, and so on and so on. So the enigma of reasoning in the sense of pondering reasons is the following. We're good at intuitive reasoning. Intuitive reasoning works very well, this kind of rapid, easy problem solving, but actually so many problems that we don't even think of as problematic and that we nevertheless solve all the time. Works pretty well. It's reliable on the whole. Of course, we make mistakes, but it's a good system. It's a good set of systems. It's a good cognitive capacity. Reasoning, on the other hand, and it's fast, and it's almost costless, almost effortless. Reasoning, on the other hand, is when you start thinking, you know, like Rodin's sculpture of the thinker with his head like this. And it's a painstaking activity. It's more effortful. We pay a certain price for reasoning. Is the benefit worth the price? Well, a lot of evidence shows that people are not very good at reasoning in this narrow sense. They make lots of mistakes. One view is, oh, maybe they correct intuitions when intuitions make mistakes, but actually when you study how people use reason, often they use it to confirm what they arrive at intuitively. So what is it good for? So that's the enigma of reason, which is not, I think, properly dealt with in standard approach to reasoning. And that's what we try to solve with the argumentative theory.
It still seems like you talk about reasoning in a broad way, but then your focus is really on this very narrow use or narrow aspect of it. I like John McMurray's definition of reasoning as objectivity, our capacity for objectivity, meaning that we can know and feel a thing in itself outside of our egocentric interpretation or use for it. Mm-hmm. So it involves intellect and emotion that are intertwined. Intellect is that conscious part. That emotion is, and I see this also as left and right brain, mm-hmm. in the nuanced, complex way that Ian McGilchrist discusses in his book, The Master and His Emissary. That really what you're talking about is really very left brain. The conscious part of it, but most of what our rationality, most of our reason is not conscious
Agree on one thing. So we both agree that there's a lot of reasoning in a broad sense going on all the time that needn't be conscious and that is really important and that is not limited to humans and so on. We probably also agree that there is reasoning going on in a more conscious way, where it involves pondering reasons. Again, there's this, the specific trait for me is the attention to the reasons for arriving at conclusions. So we shouldn't get stuck on a terminological issue, which is the best way to use the term reasoning. The argumentative theory is about reasoning in this narrow sense, which is not so narrow. And again, if you look at the psychology of reasoning, the work of people like Philip Johnson Laird or Martin Brain or Lance Ripps and so many, and Jonathan Evans, so many people have contributed to it. The work in the psychology of reasoning is also very much focused on reasoning in the sense in which the experiments we do on reasoning cause people to attend to reason. Actually, we give them the kind of time typically in a reasoning experiment, which you don't need for intuition. So even if they have an intuition initially, then they reason in the sense thinking about reason. So that's what I'm talking about, and that's what I think raises an enigma. That's what we need to explain, and I don't think the current state of psychology provides a good explanation for it.
Well, I think psychology really hasn't examined reasoning very well in general.
Okay, on that
because
that
it ignores so much. Yes, it ignores so many things we do and can are capable of.
Do you agree that there is a problem? That is, again, precisely if you are, as you seem to be, sensitive to our capacity to draw inferences, to reason in this wider sense all the time, in an unconscious manner, why do we sometimes do it in this painstaking conscious way? What's the use of that? What's the function of that? Why bother? So that's what's your answer to that question?
Well, I would. I think it's when our automatic systems for navigating the world suddenly don't work. So I study multicultural encounters and diversity. And so when you meet someone who has a different way of greeting, for example, they don't shake your hand when you put your hand out. It stops you, and you consciously have to think, what happened, and what should I do next, or is this good or bad? I mean, you start deliberating. And so I see it more for unexpected events.
It's one of the views that you find in the literature, that reasoning serves to for novel problems and so on, but, new situation. But that's true of cognition generally. I mean, cognition is about going beyond automatic behavior. That's why we have cognition.
Right.
So where is the threshold where somehow you need to move to conscious reasoning? And again, the other problem is, even assuming that there's such a threshold, conscious reasoning doesn't work very well for that. And the performance, it's not better than intuition. What we've tried to do, Hugo Mercier and I, is go in a different direction. Say, no, don't look for the benefit it brings to the individual. Trying to solve problems, meeting novel situations and so on. Think of the role it plays in human communication. And in a way, if you think about the past of history of philosophy, the philosopher Ian Hacking was sending me an email the other day saying, Aristotle would have agreed, because when you look at the history of philosophy, the beginning of the study of reasoning, are under rhetoric. So reasoning was for lawyers and politicians and to prepare arguments to convince others. So that's where the study of reasoning started. So in a way, we're going back to an Aristotelian theme, stepping over Kant and Descartes, who had a much more individual view of the function of reasoning. I want to suggest that there's, part of our theory is not just going back to Aristotle. There's something more novel about it, which has to do with the problem of trust in communication. And do you see that?
With the problem of
trust.
The problem
of trust. Trust in communication.
Trust.
Yeah, trust.
Okay. Yeah.
Uh-huh. When you're perceiving, when you're thinking on your own, your eyes, your ears, your brain, they work for yourself. I mean, they don't have interests different from yours. But we depend massively on information, ideas, suggestions made by others. We communicate all the time, as we are doing actually right now, very, very typical human activity. But others are a fantastic source of information. We owe them so much. But their interests are not identical to ours. Often their interest is, they communicate to influence us in a way that they, in which they will want to influence us. It may be generous, they may want to tell us what they, to the best of our knowledge is the truth, to inform us, but they also may want to influence us to vote for certain candidate, buy certain product, do things that they would like us to do, not see something that they don't want us to see, and so on. So in communication, there's a real problem of trust. And there are a lot of, there's a limit to how much information can flow among humans because of the limitation of trust. And this, I would argue, is where reasoning comes in. So that's the original, where the originality of the theory will appear. But I don't know if you agree with the, you know, the idea that to begin with, in communication, in human communication, we rely immensely on others, but trust cannot be 100%.
Well, I'm thinking of the evolutionary context, mm-hmm. which we spent 90% at least of our human genus yeah. history, and that's the small band hunter-gatherers. And the reports about the contemporary small band hunter-gatherers is that trust was incredibly important, of course, and that was the underpinning for the way they behaved and very egalitarian mm-hmm. in what's called a companionship kind of society. Not a kinship society, but companionship. Mm-hmm. So they came and went into the small groups based on, you know, getting along well.
Oh, sure.
And my understanding, yeah. though, they weren't susceptible to people who were conning them, who were giving them misinformation. Those people would be shunned or expelled if they were cooperative with the group.
So, okay, so then they were vigilant. They were paying attention to the risk of deception. They were not taking it easily. So, you know, even in, first I agree with you that it's an old problem in human history and social life depends on trust. But trust functions precisely because also there's a certain degree of vigilance. So we can be vigilant towards the source. There are some people whom we trust on certain things. Some people, you know, children, for instance, may talk about things about which they're not competent. So we won't automatically believe them. People may want to mislead us. Indeed, if we catch them red-handed doing that, we may react badly. But they may be our partners who cheat on us, and so we still may want to go on living with them. And in this case, disappointment in trust doesn't put an end to the relationship, and we still trust them on other matters. But let's go back to reason. What happens is this. You won't believe me on trust, I may still convince you by argument. So when trust is not sufficient for information to flow, for what I want to communicate to you to be accepted by you, like right now, basically I don't sense you as being exactly willing to believe everything I say just because I say it. So what I'm trying to do is to find arguments that will overcome the fact that you don't grant me enough authority to accept what I say just because I say it. And you're right, actually. It's perfectly normal. So the idea is that arguments producing your giving reasons is a way to convince people who you will not be convinced just because you said it, just because of your authority, for whom trust is. And so that it allows the communication of much more information than we would have if we were just based on trust, where humans are more trusting than any other animal, leaving aside social insects, who don't have the same kind of problems, more trusting than any other animals, but they're not gullible. They're aware of the fact that they can be deceived by others, and they're aware of the fact that sometimes it's advantageous for them to deceive others. Children do that from the age of four. So the view of the argumentative theory, and here we're far away from Aristotle, the argumentative theory of reasoning claims that the main function of reasoning is to produce and evaluate reasons which are given deployed in order to overcome bottlenecks in communication, bottlenecks linked to trust, the limits on the trust we have in each other. So that's the basic idea of the argumentative theory.
Okay. Yeah, I can see how that would be certainly an important part of reasoning development. I'm mm-hmm. still not certain that that's why reason evolved, though. It seems to me it's more about, again, problem solving and I would start with the mom and baby. Mm. It's the communication between mother and baby. Mm. And
There you have trust. Yeah. Babies trust their mothers. In any case, they don't have
ideally,
a choice.
Ideally, yes.
No, but they do. I mean, if you see a distrusting baby, it would be almost pathological because babies have no other choice than to trust their caretakers, typically their mother.
Because what else can they do?
How can they defend themselves?
Some don't have reliable mothers, and so they learn not to trust the mother in today's societies. But in the past, yes, they would die. Their mother, if they didn't trust the mother, and the mother trust the community to help support her in raising the baby.
Yeah.
But,
So you say you suggest that you think that this may be part of why we reason, but not the only reason. First, we're claiming that this is the main function. And I'm not sure we're right. I mean, we're developing hypotheses. I mean, I'm a scientist. I'm not a creature. So we're developing hypotheses hoping that they're correct. But we don't do that, in a vacuum. So I think the strength of a theory and why it's been attracting much attention has to do with the fact that it provides an interpretation of a lot of the evidence of the psychological literature of reasoning, a lot of very puzzling facts about human reasoning makes sense in this perspective. So again, it's an hypothesis, but with a lot of evidence in its favor.
Right, of the limited kinds of studies that have been done. But one of the ways the theory is taken is that humans evolved reasoning to manipulate others.
Yeah,
that's what do you say to that?
I say that's sad because, digress a bit, it's a stunning experience. This work with Hugo Mercier has an incredible kind of success, which I've had, from an academic point of view, I've been rather successful. But there, Hugo Mercier got interviewed in the New York Times, we got reported, our work got reported in Newsweek, we've been blogged all over the place. So on one hand, that's very nice. On the other hand, it's based to a large extent on misunderstanding. So it's as if there was an attraction to humans' reasoning is not really rational. In fact, it's just a way to exert power and to manipulate others. That's not what we're saying. And I don't think it would make any sense. I don't think it's a good theory, that the idea that reasoning is just to manipulate others. Why doesn't it make sense? Because if reasoning is about argumenting, you have got to convince others, and there are two points of views. On the one hand, from an evolutionary point of view, you've got to evolve the abilities to produce good arguments as a producer of argument, but you have a consumer of argument, the receivers, the audience, and they evolve the ability to evaluate arguments. Why should they accept arguments just because it's an argument? Arguments have the ability to take us over these bottlenecks of trust in communication precisely because they can be evaluated. There's something in the a genuine argument, which is not just produced to browbeat an incompetent audience.
Yeah.
It's something that the audience can examine. They can say, oh, yes, I can see that this is a good reason for that conclusion. Or on the contrary, they say, well, I see why you think it's a good argument, but it's not good enough to convince me. So it's a kind of honest, when it's used properly, an argument is more open to the critical evaluation of the audience than just a plain assertion. That's why when authority is not enough to convince others, when my simple assertion, it is like this, won't convince you, I may still try to argue, as I'm doing.
Well, what you're saying reminds me of the accounts from anthropologists and others who live with hunter-gatherer communities extensively, where they refuse to answer hypothetical scenarios.
Yeah.
So, should Heinz steal the drug? Yeah. Well, who's Heinz? I don't know Heinz. Do you know Heinz? How should I know what he should do? So that's how they argue. They're very concrete. They don't deal with hypotheticals.
It's a bit more complicated. I'm an anthropologist myself. I've done field work in the south of Ethiopia for a couple of years, and I've had found the kind of refusal of hypothetical that you describe. At the same time, the people whom I've studied, the wonderful people in the south of Ethiopia, they would have village meetings where they would discuss among themselves and argue very well. And in fact, in all human societies where, for instance, litigation has been studied, you find not just people having different points of views, but arguing quite well.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with children. Children from the age of 3 or 4, reason well and produce arguments in a even if they've not been trained to do so. Of course, it gets better and more sophisticated with age and special training. But reasoning, in the sense of production of argument and evaluation of argument, is a human universal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, the hunter-gatherers tend to only believe eyewitnesses. They won't believe just anything. And there's that suspicion that you're talking about. So if you haven't seen it yourself, why should they believe what you tell them?
Yes, well, so if that's a good argument, it's a good argument for all of us. So reliance on witness testimony is indeed very important. It's important in modern legal systems too. But come on, I mean, you know, hunter-gatherers, they also have religious systems and lots of stories and myths, and so they believe lots of things which are not based on witness testimony. And also, what happens when will happen in any society, in any group, sometimes you have two witnesses who have contradictory testimonies. So you have to, you know, one says, I stole it, and he stole it, and the other says, no, you give it to me. And so what do you do then? So then that's where, you know, when suddenly looking for what reasons you have to believe one more than the other become highly relevant. And that happens in every society.
Mm-hmm. So you don't subscribe to the view that people do this out of self-interest?
Self-interest is present in human activity all the time.
It's true for any animal. It's true for any life form. Self-interest is just part of trying to stay alive.
Yeah, self-interest is a pretty universal component of our action decisions and so on. And indeed, precisely, that's one of the reasons why we can't just trust each other all the time, because all of us again have interests which are different from ours. So when they tell us something, they tell us in order to influence us in specific ways, and when they do that, we want to understand if their interests are in fact incompatible with ours. And again, this is where these limits of trust. So again, trust is hugely important and effective in humans, but it's not unlimited. These limits of trust can, to some extent, under certain conditions, be overridden by argumentation and reasoning. And if you think of it, you know, I mentioned the enigma of reasoning. Why pay such a heavy price? Why think about reason? Why ponder them? Well, because it's really the only way to achieve this kind of communication over and above limits of trust with others. There is no alternative. Again, in problem solving, in everyday inference, in forming expectation, judgment, preferences, beliefs, and so on, we do that intuitively, and we do it quite well.
And so are you saying that we may not have trust built in a particular relationship, but then if you use arguments to try to communicate, that's an additional tool?
No, I think we are trusting animals. Trust is certainly part of our makeup, but it's not blind trust. It's intelligent trust. It's vigilant trust. Trust goes together with what with some colleagues we've described as epistemic vigilance. We trust each other, but not just blindly. We pay attention to other people's motives, competence, and so on. So it's not trust is not enough to ensure that all useful information, suggestions, proposals will circulate effectively in a human group, between you and your friends, you know, your family, your society. And reasoning, trying to argue for one's views, which when they're not going to be accepted and trust, examining the views of others that maybe we don't trust them enough to accept them, but we think maybe they're right nevertheless. So examining the reasons allows us to go, you know, beyond the limits of trust. But no, trust is certainly very much part of the human makeup.
Well, in my, I'm working on a biological theory of morality, uh-huh. And I think we're neglecting children now in their early life. We're not following ancestral parenting practices, and I think this has an effect on how well the different parts of the brain work. Uh-huh. So we're creating very self-centered children because they're left in distress a lot in early childhood, and so they're easily put out of kilter. and have a more difficult time with empathy and more pro-social emotions and maybe even higher order executive functions.
That's a distressing
thought. It is, but we've got, there's quite a bit of evidence I'm putting together in a book. But anyway, I think that people have less trust, and we know that in the States, trust has been diminishing over the last 30 years, for example. And our civility and our reasoning skills seem to also, at least at the political, in the political discourse, seem to be deteriorating. Do you have any comments about these things? You're a Frenchman, and I was just in France enjoying Montpellier last week. It was very wonderful. But coming back to the States, it's back to this very acrimonious kind of society in terms of trying to solve its problems. So does your theory help? Can it help?
No, it's a period. You're right. I mean, but it's a period. I mean, you know, I'm quite fascinated by American politics, and I follow it closely. So indeed, it's a period of extreme polarization, and the debate is... it's a case where people argue more for their own side to convince that they are totally committed to one side or the other rather than to convince others. So it's really striking. But you don't want to project what is happening right now in American politics and make it into a long-term trend. And when you say trust has been diminishing in the past 30 years and so on, yes, we may, you know, how do you measure it? So you may measure it on specific issues, so, you know, trust in politicians and so on. But trust one of the cements of social life, what makes us capable of living with one another, it would be pretty hard to measure, you know, how it has done, how it is evolving and so on. What's clear is that a society without any trust is just not thinkable.
Yeah, and you can see, I guess, Somalia is just tribal trust, I suppose, rather than a country political level trust.
Yeah, but wait a second. Let's not idealize the tribes. You find in traditional societies some which indeed live a life that's fairly admirable and based on much trust and cooperation and so on. All those are much more agonistic, violent, cheating is a daily affair, not teaching is considered unsophisticated and so on. So I wouldn't draw a contrast between hunters gatherers as having had the perfect balance of trust and the optimal form of morality and reasoning and so on, and us kind of just on a decline. It seems to me a more complicated picture. No? What do you think?
Well, at least what I've read about the hunter-gatherers, and I've been doing quite a bit of reading, the small band hunter-gatherers did seem to have pretty peaceful coexistence. It's when you get more complex hunter-gatherer societies, have where they are cultivating something or raising animals or something, that's when things start to break down in terms of trust and hierarchy increases and various things. But what recommendations do you have for the field of psychology, perhaps, or even philosophy, maybe both, in terms of psychology, in terms of what kinds of research it should be doing? How they might revise theory.
I don't see myself in a position of authority to make recommendations both for psychology and philosophy. But I belong to those who like to straddle both fields in fact, there is no real boundary. There are really big conceptual issues in psychology for which philosophy is extremely helpful, and there are a number of philosophical issues which are really very much illuminated by empirical evidence. I have an approach to philosophy and science where I like the joint pursuit of both activities. And I'm not saying that everybody should do like that. Do similarly, there are some scientists who have no interest for philosophy and philosophers who have no interest for science. But there's a lot of very exciting stuff going on. at the boundary between the social, the cognitive, and the cognitive science on the one hand, and philosophy on the other hand, and philosophers are really needed for us to move ahead. So that's my feeling about that.
Yes. Well, I agree. I was just also at a philosophy conference, and they presenting a lot of empirically derived theory, and I think we have a lot to learn from each other,
yes,
psychologists indeed. And philosophers.
Indeed. Yeah. But maybe we should conclude with that. We live in fairly exciting times because there's this interplay of indeed a number of fields. There's really some exciting interdisciplinary work. So even the issues we've been discussing are the boundary of psychology, anthropology, the social science, their philosophical dimension. And there are more and more people who are not only competent in approaching these issues within their own field, but who are capable of, they're competent across fields and they can talk to each other. So I think we're living exciting times, and maybe this little dialogue we've just had is just one more example of how exciting it all is.
Yes, well, thank you for contributing to the excitement.
thank you for the dialogue. I enjoyed it. Okay, bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.